Canada's involvement in Afghanistan is largely because Canadian governments in recent years have towed the American line.
Fighting terrorism, liberating women, and exporting freedom and democracy are some of the dominant discourses surrounding Canada's invasion of Afghanistan since September 11, 2001. What is the real agenda behind the West's involvement in the Middle East, and why does the war in Afghanistan have no foreseeable end? Candace Moore spoke recently with Professor Tom Workman on these questions and more for CKDU-FM.
So on the phone with me today from Fredericton, New Brunswick, is Professor Tom Workman. He teaches political science and international development studies at the University of New Brunswick. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Maybe first you could tell us some of the dominant discourses as to why Canada is at war with Afghanistan.
Well, I think the main narrative or the main story or the main set of justifications that we tend to hear has to do with the sense that there is a new or novel or opportunistic world order out there that is finally reaching a point where it can implement some goals that are shared largely by humanity. These are the goals of freedom, as we hear frequently, the goal of democracy, and the idea that this new order, this new world order, as it is sometimes called, has to involve a fundamental respect for principles of nonviolence and has to be committed to ensuring that terror, for example, is kept under control. This discourse largely has resurrected the idea that we have an opportunity for nations or countries to live peacefully as long as there is a fundamental or sound respect for principles of international law and respect for freedom and democracy. That's the dominant one. Of course, there are a number of, and I should add that most of the media, in one way or another, participates or reflects or tends to frame its news analysis in terms of that dominant account of the New World Order. There are, of course, a number of critical responses that would draw attention to the real agenda of the West, in particular the United States, and but these tend not to receive any what we might call airplay or a lot of attention in the media.
How is Canada's war in Afghanistan related to the U.S.-led war in Iraq?
How are they related? They are part of an agenda that seems to have been born by a particular American outlook in the last 15 years. Sometimes this is referred to as the doctrine of preemption. And the doctrine of preemption holds that even if we believe that there is a possibility, the we meaning the West, and particularly the United States, even if it is believed that there is a possibility that countries or regimes may not respect these principles of the New World Order, that they can be dealt with before they actually create their wars or before they fund or support terror that comes to harm the West. And in this sense, there is an underlying feeling that any kind of involvement is justified. This doctrine of preemption, I have to add, is just the latest kind of formal rationale that has been given to interventionist enterprises throughout the 20th century. At one time, it was the Reagan doctrine of rollback. At another time, it was the Carter doctrine of human rights, and at another time it was the anti-communism of the early post-war period. The name and the rationale has changed, but the nature of the behavior has never changed, and this points in the direction of extensive interference and involvement in a number of countries in the majority world.
For example, one of the dominant discourses that Canada employed, at least in the mainstream media, was that Canada was going into Afghanistan to liberate women. I was wondering if you could speak to that notion.
Yes. That was simply window dressing. That was unfortunate. The Taliban in particular were targeted as a group that had banned the education of women. And while it's true that these laws were on the books, those of us who are familiar with the relationship between gender and education throughout the majority world know that the primary cause or the primary link between education on the one hand and gender on the other has to do with poverty. We know that where there is poverty, women, for all sorts of reasons, do not receive an education. And this is a challenge that extends throughout impoverished regions of the world. All the Taliban really did was, for particular and religious reasons, pass a law that really didn't amount to very much, because women were already profoundly excluded from education because of the extensive poverty in the country. What was particularly disappointing about that rationale, as we saw it in the mainstream media, was that a concern for issues relating to women and a concern for the effects of specific laws or conflicts on women was suddenly being front and center and was being given a priority, when in so many other situations, despite the efforts of many to draw attention to the problems that women face in conflict zones and so forth, no attention is ever given to it. So in this case, attention was given to an issue as a way of developing support and promoting and forging support for the involvement, the Western involvement, the Canadian involvement in the war. It was very disappointing to see serious issues exploited that way. And it was also disappointing to see a kind of misrepresentation of the real relationship between gender and education in a country such as Afghanistan.
Could you tell us a bit about the political and economic history of Afghanistan?
Yes, a little bit. It is not a very arable country. Only about 10% of the land is arable. And it's also kind of divided by a number of ethnic groups, including, for example, the Hazara, the Pashtun, the Turkmen, and the Baloch. And the Pashtun are the dominant ethnic group, but irrespective of the ethnic divisions, which are fairly severe and have been exploited and severity has been intensified in the last 30 years, the main kind of economic and social feature of the country is the fact that that little bit of arable land, about 10%, is largely controlled by a handful of landlords. And that's the key. In this sense, the situation in Afghanistan resembles other situations in the majority world where we have seen very few people, really less than 5% of the population, owning the majority of the arable land. So what you're into a situation that is very similar to the situation we encounter in Latin America quite often, and where you have a small landlord elite, a landed elite, and a large kind of peasant labor force. It's approximately 80% of the country. The service sectors of the economy and the industrial sectors of the economy are very small and only account for 15 to 20% of the overall economic activity in the country. It's largely an agricultural country. And it's largely an agricultural country that's controlled by a very small landed elite. And this elite is roughly divided, not always, but roughly divided along these ethnic divisions of Hazara, Pashtun, and so forth. This has always been the basis of the civil strife and civil conflict in the region for its history.
Would you say that these resources are part of the reason as to why Canada is at war with Afghanistan?
No, I don't think Canada's involvement has any specific or direct links in that manner. Canada's involvement in Afghanistan is largely because Canadian governments in recent years have towed the American line. Canada is a kind of junior partner, if you will, in the global imperialist project. It's organized and staged and largely directed out of Washington. And Canada's involvement in this particular part of the world is really the product of a delicate balancing act that Canadian politicians are trying to play. They don't want to appear to be overly involved in the American efforts, so there's a much greater distance put between the Canadian position with respect to Iraq and the position in Washington, of course. But generally speaking, as Canadian politicians are trying to make the choice between which wars we support and which wars we don't get involved in indirectly, we're going to find involvement in Afghanistan or possibly involvement in a Darfur, but we're not going to see involvement in other countries. There's a kind of balancing act that Canadian politicians are engaged in, but that doesn't mean in any way that their underlying support for the basic project of Washington, especially internationally, is not strong or to be questioned. And I think certainly leaders in Washington understand that clearly for political reasons, for reasons relating to the appearance of American involvement. They would like the Canadians to be involved in absolutely everything that they're involved in. But Canada, the Canadian politicians have learned that there's more apprehension, perhaps, in the Canadian public, and therefore sometimes they're not getting involved. And in situations like Iraq, it looks good because all the talk now is how the United States can develop an exit strategy from Iraq, and Canada's involvement then looks like it was a wise choice. The important thing to understand is that Canada is basically towing the American line and getting involved just more selectively.
Could you maybe talk about the idea that might means right, which is an idea often used to justify empire?
Yes, it's used as an idea to justify both war and empire. It basically means that there's very little space for what we might call pure, genuine ethical concerns. What it basically means is ethical concerns reflect power relations in the world. If, for example, there are crimes against humanity trials in the aftermath of World War II, that's because there were victors in the aftermath of World War II. Who could put the Nazis on trial. What it means is that there's very little space in international relations, generally speaking, for ethical principles, as we might say, that in the end it all comes down to power, and whatever the powerful countries can do, they do, and their only concern is that it's spun to appear ethically. They kind of cloak it or dress it up in ethical language, in language that is a little easier or more palatable to embrace, for the public to embrace. I would add, though, that even the United States is not really doing that. They are not kind of just saying, well, that's what we want, so that's what we are doing. We want to be in Iraq because that is our obligation given our national interest. They are trying to present, the United States has been trying to present these wars of recent years as wars that are really embedded in the genuine and authentic goals of all of humanity. These are wars, they stress, about democracy. These are wars, they stress, about freedom. And they are not really comfortable with saying, well, this is really the American agenda, and the world will have to take it or leave it, and if we can prevail, we will prevail. They're hesitant to really do that. They are cloaking it or dressing it up in a language that seems palatable to many people. They are, to put this a little differently, God is on their side.
Would you call Canada's involvement in Afghanistan a colonial enterprise?
No, it's not. It's imperialist. Colonialism, I think, referred to a very specific period where there were kind of government set up for limited purposes. I think that this involvement here reflects the efforts to create institutional foundations in regions of the world that are rooted in the kind of long-term business goals and what you might call more formally accumulation strategies of the West, particularly the Western European countries, the United States and Canada, the old G7, and that this is really the goal. And in the case of Afghanistan, the eye is on, in part, but not exclusively, on the very oil-rich East Caspian Sea region.
Foreign Affairs Minister Peter MacKay recently announced that Canadian troops will continue to fight in Afghanistan for an unforeseeable amount of time, possibly more than 5 years, as part of Canada's commitment to NATO. Why does the war have no end in sight?
The war has no end in sight because the current government was installed by the West, and Afghanis see that that way. This is not the social problems, and the challenges facing Afghanis are intractable in ways that don't lend themselves to easy solutions. The West cannot kind of impose a regime and then have the Afghanis go along because they embrace the principles of freedom and democracy. It just doesn't work that way. There are high stakes for the various ethnic groups. There are high stakes for the various tribal affiliations, the various tribes and the tribal affiliations that have been developed. And all of those factors are linked directly to the landlords and who's actually controlling agricultural production. And these stakes are extraordinarily high. The country is always poised to fragment into a kind of series of civil wars. We've seen that especially in the 1980s. We have to remember that the regime that was installed had a worse human rights record than the Taliban. And we have to remember that that regime was a loose coalition of fighting groups that had bases all over the country, especially in the north. And that it was always a tenuous kind of alliance. And what we're seeing now is just the playing out of these deep cleavages, especially the class cleavages, in the country. When the West waltzes in, imposes or establishes its own regime, that regime is not obviously going to be easily embraced by Afghanis. I think the civil war is destined to continue for quite a while. The only way that it will end is if there is and this is a horrible thought, if there is the commitment not to a quasi-democratic regime, but rather to a repressive regime. We have tended to see in post-World War II history that when there are deep class and ethnic cleavages in countries, the more repressive regime, the more quote-unquote stable the country appears to be. It was the case that even George Bush Sr., the current leaders, the current president of the United States' father, saw that even in the case of Iraq, this was what was true, and that's why he kept Saddam Hussein in power in the aftermath of the 1991 war, when the Iraqi military was decimated, and when Schwarzkopf was on his way to Baghdad to seize Saddam Hussein, and Bush Sr. said stop, and this even caused a bit of a rift between the American military and the president of the United States, who was the commander-in-chief. And Schwarzkopf had to apologize because his military instincts were to go and get Saddam Hussein, and George Bush Sr. said stop. And the reason he said stop, because his advisors were telling him that Saddam Hussein, as repressive as he is the only person who can hold that country together. These countries fall apart when the regimes, the extremely repressive regimes that were holding them together, are removed. And inevitably and invariably, they lapse into a rather protracted period of civil war that's rooted in these deep divisions, and these wars are not going to be drawn to an easy conclusion.
Should Canada pull out of Afghanistan?
Canada shouldn't have been there in the first place, but you have to look at the reality of the Canadian situation. Canada is very much a kind of junior partner, a little Joe to Hoss, with respect to the American kind of global capitalist project. Canada is going to be occasionally involved in these wars. This is not perhaps all that appealing thought to most Canadians. But they may pull out, but I rather doubt it. It will depend on how many Canadians are coming home in body bags. I think in the end, and what kind of electoral mileage particular candidates might get out of this. In the end, they, of course, shouldn't have been in there. And in the end, they'll only come back if there's if you start to see the Canadian public becoming convinced that this really is just an inescapable problem, and perhaps one that we shouldn't have been mired in the first place. None of these sentiments really speak to the truth of the situation, that is, why Canada was involved in the first place and what the real problems are in Afghanistan. But I think it's going to largely come down to the sense that political leaders have of the severity of Canadian public opinion.
What kind of resistance would be most effective either by Canadians or the people in Afghanistan to see an end to the war?
Yeah, unfortunately, protests have not tended to end wars. We saw protests throughout the 20th century, and I don't think protests really ended the war. There's a kind of romantic idea that that's what brought a conclusion, or at least helped to bring a conclusion to American involvement, the American invasion, I should say, in Vietnam. I rather doubt that that was the case. So the protests, while they are undertaken, are probably not all that effective. Having said that, though, there is a sense in which the protests may have an impact on Canadian public opinion. And I think in the end, Canadian politicians are going to wet their finger and stick it up in the air and try to get a sense of the mood of Canadians with respect to this, with respect to their involvement in Afghanistan. And again, that mood's going to be affected in a significant way by the feeling that there is confidence, whether or not there appears to be some kind of conclusion that is achievable. It's also going to be affected by how many Canadians are actually being injured or killed in the war. But in the end, the politicians are going to kind of gauge Canadian public opinion, try to gauge the mood of the Canadian electorate, and that's ultimately what's going to affect their decision.
Great. Thanks a lot, Professor Tom Workman. Is there anything else you'd like to add or any final comments you'd like to share with our listeners about this subject?
The only one I would want to add is that it is the situation in Afghanistan and the situation in Iraq right now is horrible beyond our wildest imagination. And I should also add the situation we recently saw in August of this year with respect to the South Lebanon. These countries have fallen apart, and the civilians in these countries, typical Afghanis, typical Iraqis, typical Lebanese, are paying a horrible price. And the costs we can barely, the costs in terms of the quality of their lives is difficult to appreciate from the Western vantage point. We tend not to see it reported on in the news. We don't know, for example, we don't hear in the news that regularly that cluster bombs have been dropped or that other kinds of terrible weapons have been used, and we don't tend to hear about the horrible harm that this inflicts on the civilian population. We tend to see a lot of misrepresentation or very selective representation that creates a distorted image of these regions. We have made things very, very bad.
You have been listening to an interview with Professor Tom Workman, teacher of political science and international development studies at the University of New Brunswick in Fredericton. He is also the author of several books, including The Social Origins of the Iran-Iraq War and Social Torment, Globalization in Atlantic Canada. This interview is produced by Candace Moores for CKDU-FM in Halifax.